Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics Podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Jawley. Before we begin, some exciting news. We are taking part in Podcast Live, a new event bringing your favourite podcasts under one roof. Join us on Sunday, April the 7th in central London. To book tickets, go to podcastlive.com. And if you're a subscriber to my morning email, you can get a 10% discount using the code you can find there. Right, in-house plug over, down to this week. And instead of rounding up Times columnists to tell us what they think is happening in Britain, I thought we'd take a slightly more international approach. So I've assembled three UK-based foreign correspondents from other European countries to help try to explain how we are being viewed elsewhere in Europe. And maybe together we'll all try to work out what on earth is going on with Brexit. So joining me, Tim DeWitt is UK and Ireland correspondent for Dutch public service broadcaster NOS. Katrin Pibble is UK correspondent for German newspapers. And Christina Marconi is an Italian journalist. And they're all based in London. Welcome to you all. Thank you for joining us. Before we get down to the hugely interesting topic of Brexit, let's start with just what does being a forward correspondent, because we think of foreign correspondents being in sort of glamorous, far-flung places with, you know, better weather and, or, you know, war or whatever. What does Christina, start with you. What does being a foreign correspondent in London involve?
A lot of coverage of the royal family, which is a little bit like maybe the exotic bit is definitely the royal family. And then I think it's a little bit like being correspondent from the future, really. It is not a country, but definitely a city, which has a lot of new things going on, a lot of innovation. So it's very exciting. And I would say correspondent from the future as well, because of what's happening now in terms of relation with the European Union. So it is a very articulate, and it's a very exciting kind of job, which brings me definitely to write about culture, about fashion. Unfortunately, the political side is, of course, taking the center stage at the moment. But I think it's one of the best posts as a correspondent you can have. I mean, before that, I was in Brussels, where everything had to be seen through the European lens, in a way. Whereas from London, it's more international, it's more exciting, it's more diverse. And also, I have to mention, as an Italian correspondent, that we have a huge Italian community here, and a huge Italian community of people who are either they spend a year in London, they are planning to spend some years in London when they're looking for work, and that's a very interesting phenomenon to observe. And also, it's very important to give these people the right information about what will happen, what the city is giving them, what the country is happening. I mean, what the country is, where it is going, really, in order for them to make plans.
Katrin, is it a good posting for you, London?
Britain? Oh, I absolutely love it. But when I came here in 2014, everyone was like, ooh, that's almost a bit boring politically, you know? And I was like, yeah, you're right. Because there were like David Cameron, Nick Clegg, you know, Ed Miliband. They sort of, from abroad, they sort of looked the same. They were the same.
Well, that was also true here. That was,
exactly.
We thought they all looked the
exactly.
same. Exactly.
And so, at some point, I was like, oh, that's a bit of a shame. But of course, there's so many other things, and it's quirky stories, it's lighthearted stuff. And in Germany in particular, they love the Britishness. And, I know that's very basic, but they sort of love every story where there's a red bus involved or, you know, like this kind of very cliche sort of Britain. And, of course, the royals, hugely popular in Germany as well. But, of course, after, Scottish referendum and general election, and then, of course, the referendum, EU referendum, it's nowadays just Brexit, basically, or 95% of what I do is Brexit.
You're nodding as well, Tim.
Yeah, I think it's even more than 95%. Is it possible? Yeah, almost. No, it's the same.
Well, Megan is pregnant, to be fair.
Well, yeah. No, but it is indeed.
So it's 95% Brexit, then 5% of Megan is pregnant. That's it. That is Britain
here
and all.
We go.
Yeah. Well, it is. Yeah. And I moved here early 2015, so like 4 years ago, and I was in the same position as Catherine explained. Like, because the nice thing about being a foreign correspondent is you have the variety of all the stories coming towards you. You're very a general affairs kind of covering journalist, you know, so it's from sports to culture to politics to, and that's what the job involves. And now it's just mainly politics, only politics. Yeah.
So that presumably is the appeal of being a foreign correspondent. You do get to do everything, and you know, and rather than getting totally bogged down in one thing.
Well, I guess it's the problem is we're going around in circles. If it was at least a bit of a, you know, exciting political situation, and it is exciting, I don't want to play it down. But of course, I'm just a bit lost sometimes because what else to say, you know? And like, of course,
we're only too familiar with that on the podcast. Like, how many more times could we go around the houses?
Exactly.
And nothing has happened.
And the problem is, like, of course, British colleagues can go into detail. For us, I mean, I still have to explain the basics all the time because in Germany, you know, they don't have it, of course, on the cards all the time.
I don't think anybody here really totally follows all the detail. Christina, what happens then? Let's talk us through like your typical day. What is it? You calling a news desk and saying Theresa May is giving another Brexit statement and she's going to say the same thing as last time. And they're like, no, we really don't want any more of that. Or are they calling you and saying, we can't get enough of Theresa May saying the same thing over and over again?
I try to send an email to all my newspapers every morning. Usually they will say in the morning, oh no, not another like day for Theresa May. We are not going to cover this. This is too boring. Then, given the Italian newspapers, they tend to close very late at night. By 6 in the afternoon, they will call me and say like, okay, this is very important. You have to write something. You have to write a story.
On the Theresa May thing that they didn't want in the morning. Yeah.
And also there is another thing, which is, it is a very intricate story. It's very complicated, which means that every time someone will write a children's version of Brexit, everyone will get very excited from Rome saying, oh, we have this story where Brexit is being delayed of 2 years. I mean, it's an official saying this in Brussels, very interesting, doesn't mean it will happen. But at least it's a clear headline, so they like it because it's clear. It's much better than maybe, you know, on Wednesday we might have emotion. And this is very hard to explain. So, yeah, I would say like I start in the morning in a desert of uninterest and have to wake up in the afternoon when everyone gets excited.
Tim, you were nodding there as well.
The difficulty is for every journalist in the UK at the moment is no one has a real clue of what will happen, you know, in the future. And that's the question we probably all get every morning as well. I mean, my broadcaster sent me to this country to understand what's going to happen. And then I have to explain to them every day, like, I'm not too sure, you know. Like, for example, this weekend again, like, we were focusing a bit on will there be another meaningful vote this week? And then involves a lot of preparation because that means probably they will have to send some extra colleagues over, some extra camera crews, because that's something we need to cover quite big. And then on Sunday, again, Theresa May says, well, actually, I gave it a thought and the next date is the 12th of March. And yeah, who knows? Will it happen then, or will it be definitely will be going down to the 28th of March? So that makes it really hard as a correspondent as well, because the audience I work for, and Catherine pointed towards it already, is not as involved as the British are, obviously,
yeah,
because it won't affect them as much. So if it comes down all the time to a debate about the backstop, I mean, editors to me say, you can't use the word backstop. You just can't use it because people will turn
it's
their
like
TV
off. You're going to talk for an hour about Brexit, but you're not allowed to use the word backstop.
Exactly. Yeah. And it makes it really hard. So you have to explain it to an audience which is interested, because there's a lot at stake as well economically for the Netherlands, for example, and for other European countries as well, of course, especially when it comes to no deal and those kind of things. But you cannot go into the same level of detail as British journalists are allowed to. Does it makes it the job as a foreign correspondent, I think, pretty hard at the moment as well here.
Do you agree, Katrine?
Oh, yes. And on top of that, you also have this sort of different sentiment in, for example, I mean, I can only speak for Germany. They don't like Brexit at all, and they just can't believe why Britain is doing this. And actually, you would feel, or you would see the same feelings in, among my editors. Like, they are always very sort of interested whenever there's a story about any poll which says, oh, you know, the British public is changing its mind.
Yeah.
And I always have to say, calm down, Brexit is gonna happen. So basically, I do think that was the main message in the past years I tried to get across, that Brexit is going to happen. And still today, they're like, is there any chance the Brits could not leave? Because for them, it's just like, they won't believe it. And it's not only about economical damage or anything. It's just like, you would find the same, or like, if you go to Germany and you talk to people, they're always like, why would you damage yourself so much? Like, what's the point, you know? So, and it's not only about economics, it's also about that, of course, the Germans feel differently about the EU, about the Union, you know, about everything. So, I think part of our job was to explain why Brexit happened in the first place. And that is an ongoing challenge, I guess.
I remember the day after the referendum in 2016, there was a story which was picked up at my broadcaster quite bigly. It was a petition signed by a lot of people straight away that they wanted to reverse the result, right? So I think it was 1 million.
It took off really quickly. Yeah.
Yeah. So they thought, okay, well, this is a clear signal that the country just doesn't want this. And then you just have to keep on explaining, like, this is not, this is going to happen, you know? A majority of the people voted for it. It's a democratic decision. I mean, whether you like it or not is a different matter.
And do you have to be careful? I mean, are you a German or a Dutch or Italian voice here? And so you sort of reflect, you know, so you end up basically just writing stories showing it's all a terrible idea. Or do you find that because you've been here for a few years, you go a bit native, and actually a development which is good for Britain but possibly bad for the EU or other European countries? Do you know what I mean? Whose side are you on when you're sort of...
Well, you're the Brit, aren't you?
Yeah.
A bit.
Yeah.
You kind of are the link between those two countries in a way. And to explain the British... I mean, I don't want to say I can explain Britain or the British culture or the thinking. I would not go that far. But of course, you have to see it through a German or Dutch or Italian sort of perspective, and to explain it as well.
Yeah.
In Italy, as you know, the relationship with the European Union has been very difficult in the past few years. So, of course, Brexit means also covering something which might be a path other countries might want to follow. So, yeah, there is a lot of like trying to bridge the gap between the wishful thinking of Italians who think like, oh, the you know, a part of the government thinks, oh, finally a country is just rebelling against the big European behemoth. And other things, oh, we're so sorry to see them leave, just like you were mentioning, I mean, Germans before. So there is a lot of, try also to show that if you really want to be a good Eurosceptic, there are a few mistakes you shouldn't be making. No, it's true. I mean, if you're like a very, you know,
we're the trailblazers to show how not to do it, and then other countries who can follow could do it better.
I think there is definitely this side of the story. Well, I mean, you'd rather make clear from the beginning what kind of break up with the European Union you want, because it doesn't, I mean, I don't know how it will end, but for sure we have a very tired prime minister, we have a very discredited parliament. I mean, I don't think he will ever be seen as a model of like a good political I don't know how to call it, mission or whatever. So there is definitely this bit. And also,
see, that was really interesting because I came, we all met a couple of weeks ago, and I came and spoke to the Foreign Press Association. Yes. The thing that really struck me was sort of real concern, I thought, amongst all the foreign correspondents about Britain losing its reputation.
Yeah.
And yeah. for being sort of competent, and you were saying a bit dull. You know, other yeah. European countries were the yeah. ones who were a bit crazy and everything was sort of in total chaos. And Britain was sort of steady, and they were the sort of ones that everyone sort of looked
Common
to.
Common sense,
yeah. exactly. Yeah. But Brexit has changed that. And, you know, the trouble is it's a reputation which is hard won but sort of mm-hmm. easily lost. Is that shared across definitely. All of your countries?
Oh, definitely. There is just one thing I would like to tell you, because maybe you didn't notice it, but Silvio Berlusconi, who has been quite in the news in the past decade, on his Twitter account, says that he's praying for Britain.
Wow.
Yes. You should definitely check this Berlusconi is because he says like hilarious things.
In a new
about
low for Theresa May.
He said, I think recently he said he has a plan to reverse Brexit.
Maybe he should
morning.
Invite Theresa May to one of his bunga bunga parties. And that would. Tim, is that the same in the Netherlands, that people look across to Britain and think, what are we doing?
What on earth? Yeah, definitely. What I find fascinating as well is, if from a political perspective, I mean, the UK has also been regarded by the Netherlands as a very important ally. I mean, you can even see it. Mark Rutte is someone who is always involved in talks with Theresa May when it comes to bilateral meetings, when he's been invited to Downing Street quite a number of times. So we are, I think, also regarded, seen from London as an important ally. And without the UK in the EU, the Netherlands has to reposition itself, literally, because yeah. now it's just the German, like the Paris-Berlin acts, which yeah. they have to deal with. And they were actually always very happy with that, like, bit difficult voice coming from London, you know, not to push the brake a bit on further integration and things like that. So from the Dutch perspective, it's like a huge loss that the UK won't be part of the EU anymore. And actually, if you look at, because in the past, we had a referendum on the European Constitution in 2005, was voted against. So there is quite a bit of Euroscepticism in the Netherlands as well. But actually, because of the whole Brexit process, you could see that the support for the EU has gone up, actually. So that those voices have been dimmed.
Yeah.
Because everybody can see how difficult it is and also what it could do to your country.
Well, so what, in a sec, I want to ask you about individual personalities, but we'll be back after this short break.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Red Box Politics Podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Jolly, joined by Christina, Tim and Katrine. Let's talk about some of the individual personalities. So let's start with the other one. Theresa May. How is Theresa May seen in your various countries? Let's start with you, Katrine.
I think it's quite a tricky question because in some ways, Theresa May was always seen as quite reasonable one. So whenever I criticised in some sort of commentaries or whatever the Prime Minister, I would get very angry letters from readers, which is quite astonishing, I think. But then they all blame Boris Johnson and, you know, like the Brexiteers for the mess where Britain is in. And so I'm finding that quite interesting that they are still, not all of them, but like lots of people in Germany still sort of see Theresa May as the good politician who tries to get out of this mess or to sort of like manage the mess Britain is in. But that also shows how far away sometimes readers or listeners or, you know, the audience in other countries are.
But also, I suppose there's a sort of time lag on it, because in a way she had still had that reputation in the UK probably up until before Christmas, and it sort of started to wobble a bit that, you know, maybe... I mean, I was telling people that 2 years ago she didn't know what she was doing, but they didn't listen. What about you, Tim? What do you and your viewers think of Theresa May?
I hear sometimes Dutch politicians talk about Theresa May with quite a bit of respect and saying like, wow, look at what she's been through and all the pressure she's under, and she's still doing the job, actually. And I think, I mean, being a correspondent, trying to speculate on what will happen to her, and I mean, I've sent her to the grave so many times already. I wouldn't do that anymore. But it also shows people in a country like the Netherlands as well, like, wow, this is astonishing. But the other side is, of course, that if you look at the political decisions she has been making over the last 2.5 years, she just made like quite a number of mistakes, big mistakes. So that's the other side of the story, which is all obviously being seen in the Netherlands as well. And as Catherine mentioned, I mean, if there is any anger towards Brexit, then it's always focused on the Brexiteers, especially. Yeah.
And how far?
And especially Boris Johnson, to be fair.
So it's interesting that, because Boris Johnson was a backbench MP before the referendum happened. I mean, he had been London mayor. Was he known before? So he was known because he'd been London mayor, and he was sort of...
It was very iconic, very easy to recognise. So then you had done the thing during the Olympic Games. It was very well known. And also, I mean, I write for a conservative newspaper, Il Foglio, and they're always like looking for someone who might, you know, show the way for conservatism. And maybe years ago, there was some interest for Boris Johnson because he seemed to be a guy with ideas. Then, like, respect for Theresa May, you know, and a lot of sympathy. But where is she really going in political terms? Being a freelancer, I have several publications I contribute to. And a couple of weeks ago, I got a phone call from the editor of the Italian edition of Elle. And they said, look, I mean, she's making a lot of mistakes, but we have to say something really nice about this girl because she's really a fighter. And so I write a piece, and I was really thinking this. I mean, I feel a lot of sympathy for what she has been through. I think it's unbelievable the strength, the resilience she's showing. And it's just a pity it's not coming with a stronger political vision.
Yeah, her ability to keep on going is extraordinary. Her ability to not know where she's going is a separate point. What about the other Brexiteers then? I'm interested in sort of how far down the sort of pecking order of people that we all sort of know. You know, do you get to sort of Nigel Farage, David Davis, Michael Gove?
No. I would say Jacob Rees-Mogg. Like, you need to have some sort of personalities, I guess. And the crazier, the better, you know. But, of course, you have Jacob Rees-Mogg and Boris Johnson, very, you know. And, of course, Nigel Farage, and I would say. But even, like, it's very tricky because you can't get, like, even Jeremy Hunt, I would say, is not, you know, very sort of like known, well known. So you only always have a bunch of few politicians you can actually portray.
Because it just gets too confusing. You just think, I can't. I found that I read, it's sort of a similar thing. I read the Bob Woodward book about Donald Trump's White House, and it's so detailed with so many people. You just sort of couldn't follow it in the end because every person spoke in every meeting, and there's just sort of too many people. And it's a bit the same as that. You don't want a huge cast of characters if people are trying to follow this story from a distance.
And to be fair, they're changing.
Exactly,
so
that is the other problem. They do keep changing all the time.
You know, it is quite hard for a foreign journalist to interview a British politician among the several clever things Nigel Farage did is that he was very available to the foreign press. So, I mean, I interviewed
Nigel Farage was happy to speak to the media. This seems so unlikely.
Yes.
We had no idea.
He was very happy to speak to the foreign media with like good one-liners, good headlines. And this gave him, I would say, like, it was punching far above his weight. Everyone is surprised that actually he was never an MP, that because at some point he seemed to be like the official voice of Britain. It was due to the fact that it was so hard to interview them, and it was always there.
So it's not right. The British politicians still won't.
I had an interview with Tony Blair the other week, but they take months to, you know, just send him emails and emails, or to his people especially, and same with ministers. I mean, probably the same with you. I never got access to any ministers or secretaries of state, or that's, I don't think they're really interested in talking to the foreign press. And I find it astonishing. I mean, if the BBC would try to get Mark Rutte on the programme tonight, they would get him straight away. he knows that it's very important to show in other countries in Europe as well to what your opinion is, what your stance is, and also your visibility is important.
Has that changed since Brexit? Were they more keen to speak to you before?
Only.
Like, can you remember, Tim? Like, before the referendum, when the negotiations were still, you know, going on with David Cameron, that's when they started to have briefings. And I was, I mean, we were always
all
like,
all of a sudden
briefings
we were invited to Downing Street.
Exactly. Like, and we were like, excuse me? But, you know, it was, of course, they realized, negotiations we are actually having with the EU and European countries. And let's face it, Angela Merkel or whoever, they're not reading the Daily Mail every day.
Yeah.
But they're reading our papers or watching our news. Yeah. But it sort of stopped again. I mean, there's some briefings, but no access whatsoever.
I mean, we are still in very much a negotiation.
It's such an insular thinking of the political establishment in this country. It's only going to the domestic audience all the time. So I'm sometimes not surprised at all that there's no progress at all because, like, they don't talk to the EU,
Which is basically spending all of their time negotiating with their own party. It's all about negotiation with the British Parliament.
And another interesting reason, I think, is that speaking a foreign language is not a really common British thing to do, you know? So we all speak English, but there are hardly any English-speaking people in this country reading German newspapers or watching French television. But everybody, a lot of people in the Netherlands read the BBC website. It's very common, so it's very easy to access. So it's also very well known. And the other way around, no one watches the Dutch news here.
Isn't that a problem in a way? Because they don't even see how bad the coverage of Britain is. It's really astonishing sometimes how bad it became in the past years, what kind of headlines and how Britain is seen. And that is, I think it would be so good for politicians, but also for, you know, like all the departments to actually see what kind of damage lots of things they say or, you know, do, what kind of damage it does to the country.
Just to add quickly, because I was lucky, for example, that a few MPs had a Dutch connection. So Jess Phillips's brother apparently lives in the Netherlands.
Oh, okay.
So therefore, she's more willing to give an interview because then she knows her brother will see it on television. I find that really funny.
You need like a massive like network.
Exactly.
They went on a holiday to Germany once.
Yeah. Or Nick Clegg, for example.
Yeah, of course, Nick
speaks
Clegg.
Dutch,
but also he speaks languages, so maybe he was slightly.
But those
less.
Kind of little things are very helpful. But it's just a tiny few who really give you access. Yeah, I have to admit.
Right, Christina, let's try another politician, Jeremy Corbyn. Does he have any reach beyond Britain?
There was a lot of interest, so our left parties are like in state of soul searching. I've been in a state of soul searching for the past 10 years. So they were, at some point, they were thinking, oh, maybe that's the answer, to be like a Trotskyist, just the way our uncles used to be. Then there was a growing frustration for the fact that he didn't react. I mean, he wasn't playing the positive hero in the Brexit battle, so he wasn't doing what people would expect from like people who think that Brexit will be reversed tomorrow. He wasn't playing the hero. I'm writing a piece about him, about his biography today. No, I don't think, again, like looking for political models, he has been definitely a...
And does it matter if he says something on Brexit? No. Is that sort of news?
Not really. And also the other thing is that I guess, at least in my country, there is a fear that he might be too much on the left. If he was more effective than he is, he could be dangerous in a way. I think there is a little bit this bit with Jeremy Corbyn, which of course makes him very sexy to far left political parties.
I very much agree with you. I think the interesting thing was, I remember when Jeremy Corbyn became a leader and, for example, the membership rocketed sky high. Even members of the Dutch Labour Party visited people from the British Labour Party to see, like, what are we doing wrong? Because we are just going down in the polls. We're just a minority in Dutch Parliament at the moment. So what can we learn from the move, the Labour move we made in the UK? But now things are changing because of the anti-Semitism stories especially and his unclear stance on Brexit. That I think that makes it really hard to read him. And is he, it is obviously very hard for any Labour leader, I think, but for him especially, being a well-known Eurosceptic for decades and now leading the party, which is overwhelmingly in favour of remaining in the EU, and he feels the need that he has to deliver on the referendum result. I mean, that is just a very difficult position to be in any circumstance. But so, indeed, he's obviously well-known as well. He's one of the characters Dutch people will recognise. I think if you ask people on the street, like, how would you describe Jeremy Corbyn? It's like old leftish, Marxist. Those kind of words will pop up immediately, I think.
Is the same true in Germany?
Yes, I don't do pieces on Jeremy Corbyn that often. I do think also that part of it and the reason is that we, like all of us, don't do so much coverage just based on sound bites as it is in Britain. So I would say big part of my work is also just to leave London and go to Ireland or Northern Ireland or Northern England or wherever and to do more features and more background.
That's
so it's not only about every day, or Jeremy Corbyn said this and Theresa May said that. It's, of course you kind of have to see the whole background and the whole story.
So it's slightly taking a step back and looking at more long-term trends or rather than every tiny new one.
Yes. I mean, of course, you can't do it. Like, Britain is not the centre of the world, I'm afraid to say.
What?
So it's not... Did I really say that? But, of course, you wouldn't find stories on Britain every single day in the papers.
So that gives you a bit more time. Before we wrap up, we should speak about your countries as well. And one of the perceptions, especially with Angela Merkel and Mark Rutte, was always that they were our closest allies in the EU and they were going to come to our rescue in the end, because they always do, even though they didn't really join David Cameron's renegotiation. They haven't really with that one. What is the relationship like between Theresa May and Angela Merkel?
I mean, I would say there is a good relationship between Angela Merkel and Theresa May. There has always been a good relationship between Germany and Britain. And of course, for Germany, Britain as a member in the EU was or is very important. But then at the same time, there has been always this misunderstanding that Germany will help at any cost. Yeah. And Britain or British governments, I would say governments, like it's not only Theresa May, but also David Cameron, they have always underestimated how important it is for Germany to have the integrity of the single market, to have the EU as a political union, as a sign of democracy. It's like, there's more to it than just business and numbers and money. The Brits never understood that. But then at the same time, the Germans never understood the Euroscepticism in this country. So I do think we are in this situation now because they both sort of, they got on with each other. They sort of like both needed each other as well. But at the end of the day, it just never really sort of...
We didn't understand each other.
No.
We thought they'd always help us.
And
they thought
makers,
we were never going to leave.
But why, still till this very day, you hear German car makers. I can't believe it anymore. And I don't really want to hear it anymore. Because they were right at the start very clear that it's more important to keep the EU27 together, to have the single market, than to actually sort of help the Brits or lobby the German government to get a great deal for Britain, just to kind of sell. I mean, it's a lot of cars in Britain, but at the same time, it's only Britain. It's not the 27 and have the single market.
And is the same true, Tim, of the relationship with Mark Rutte, who again was always, David Cameron's closest ally, and then Theresa May tried to sort of keep that relationship going?
Well, I think they get along quite well. And I think what I mean, the Dutch directness is probably something pretty helpful in these in these times. So I think Margaret is also able to explain very clearly what the EU position is. Well, the Dutch are very pragmatic in this whole thing. We have a less of an emotional connection to the EU as the Germans have, but a very economic connection to it. And indeed, the integrity of the single market is the number one priority for the Netherlands as well. I mean, the UK is our second biggest export partner, but Germany is the biggest. So, and obviously, the relationship with Berlin is therefore more important than the relationship with London. And that's always important to keep in mind if you see what Mark Rutte is doing. But he obviously want to avoid a no-deal scenario, because that will be very, very damaging for the Netherlands especially. But on the other side, the Netherlands is also one of the few countries who are actually really prepared for a no-deal scenario. Instead of, well, I wouldn't say the UK is not prepared at all, but I think, I mean, there are very, I mean, we had this ridiculous Brexit monster on the desk.
The big blue monster, yeah.
The blue monster on the desk of our foreign secretary. But it actually helped, again, to create awareness amongst Dutch businesses that they really need to prepare. And in that week, I just looked it up this morning, 11,000 Dutch businesses, because of all the fuss about this Brexit monster, and it was in the news all over again, they decided to go through a whole scanning process to prepare their business for the worst possible outcome.
But that's what we need. We need a big blue hairy monster.
Well, maybe it works. Yeah. But it tells you that. So it's from a Dutch perspective, it's really about the economics.
Yeah.
So because of that whole preparation, the building up of that no-deal preparation, the Dutch are less fearful than they were, I think, 2 years ago, of what might happen, because they have a pretty good picture of what will happen. Of course, there will be damage, but they are now much better prepared than they were 2 years ago. And I think that's also underestimated in the UK, that they think, well, of course, Margaret is on our side because he wants to avoid no deal. Yes, he wants to avoid it, but he actually prepared.
He's also quite ready for it as well.
Exactly, yeah. That's the thing.
And just finally, in Italy, we've just seen in the past 24 hours Theresa May playing pool with Giuseppe Conte. This suggests that all is well. I mean, apart from the fact that Theresa May's clearly never seen anyone play pool or snooker, or she seemed utterly bad. I mean, if she'd have got out a tennis racket and had a go at the cue ball, I wouldn't have been surprised. But this suggests some generosity, not least because the video cut out just as she hit the ball, which I assume was sort of some sort of way of expressing goodwill.
Even worse.
Exactly, the ball probably shot off and hit somebody on the head or something. But what's the relationship like, do you think, with Conte?
But the problem is that our Prime Minister at the moment is not really representative of the situation in Italy. So I think, I mean, they might enjoy a good time together, you know, having fun, because they come from...
I'm not sure you would describe what was going on there as a good time. But
surely more than what they have to endure when back in their country, because, I mean, we are very... Again, like soul searching is probably the term that comes to mind when I have to describe Italy, you know, a government which is mainly made of two men and one trying to them like think the same. So I would say that Brexit for Italians is mainly the main concern is really the community of Italians here, which is huge. The lack of details about the future. So for us, it's really a concern about what will happen with this generation.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating. We should get you back when we finally get to the end of... when we finally get to the end of Brexit.
That's 50 years.
Yeah, exactly. 50 years' time. We'll come back and see how we all got on. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Acast, Spotify, or wherever you get your episodes from. You can also sign up to my morning email. Go to thetimes.co.uk/redbox, where you can also get that code to get 10% off your ticket to Podcast Live. Go to podcastlive.com to get tickets for that. But for now, my thanks to Tim DeWitt, Catherine Pibble, and Christina Marconi. For me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.